They were playing a recording of Stardust. Stardust, the stranger said. But I guess you know, it was written by a friend of mine, Hoagy Carmichael. He makes $6,000-$7,000 a year on royalties from that song alone. He's a good friend of mine. I've never met him, but I've corresponded with him. I guess it must seem funny to you that I have a friend I've never met. But Hoagy's a real friend of mine. That statement seemed much more melodic and expressive to Anne than the music. Its juxtaposition, its apparent pointlessness, and the rhythm seemed to her like the music of her own country. And she remembered walking, as a girl, past the piles of sawdust at the spoon factory to the house of her best friend. If she made the walk in the afternoon, she would sometimes have to wait at the grade crossing for a freight to pass. First there would be a sound in the distance like a cave of winds, and then the iron thunder, the clangor of the wheels. The freights went through there at full speed. They stormed through. But reading the lettering on the cars used to move her, used to remind her not of any glamorous promise at the end of the line, but of the breadth and vastness of her own country, as if the states of the Union, wheat states, oil states, coal states, maritime states, were being drawn down the track near where she stood and where she read Southern Pacific, Baltimore and Ohio, Nickel Plate, New York Central, Great Western, Rock Island, Santa Fe, Lackawanna, Pennsylvania, clackety-clacking out of sight. "Don't cry, lady," Mr. Stebbins said. "Don't cry." It was time to go home, and she got a plane for Orly that night and another plane for Idlewild the next evening. She was going home. She was going home. Her heart was in her throat. How dark and fresh the water of the Atlantic looked after all those years away. In the morning light, the low-lying islands with Indian names passed under their starboard wing, and even the houses of Long Island, arranged like the grids of a waffle iron, excited her. They circled the field once and came down. She planned to find a lunch counter in the airport and order a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. She gripped her umbrella, Parisian, and her handbag, Sienese, and waited her turn to leave the plane. But as she was coming down the steps, even before her shoes, Roman, had touched her native earth, she heard a mechanic who was working on a DC-7 at the next gate, singing, "Oh, humid Isabella, never kissed a fella." She never left the airport. She took the next plane back to Orly and joined those hundreds, those thousands of Americans who streamed through Europe, gay or sad, as if they were a truly homeless people. They round a street corner in Innsbruck, 30 strong, and vanish. They swarm over a bridge in Venice and are gone. They can be heard asking for ketchup in a guesthouse above the clouds of the Great Massif, and be seen poking among the sea caves with masks and snorkels and the deep waters off Porta San Stefano. She spent the autumn in Paris. Kitzbühel saw her. She was in Rome for the horse show and in Siena for the Palio. She was always on the move, dreaming of bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches.
Nathan Osgood was reading A Woman Without a Country by John Cheever. The producer was Duncan Minchin. Welcome back to Sweden in South Kensington from me, Martin Handley, and to tonight's BBC Prom Live here on Radio 3. On stage this evening is the Swedish Chamber Orchestra Örebro, a city in the centre of the country which has been the orchestra's home since its inception 15 years ago. Its chief conductor for all bar the first couple of years of that span has been the Dane Thomas Dausgaard, whose second appearance at this year's proms this is. He's already visited with his other orchestra, of course, the Danish National Symphony. Well, the Swedish Chamber Orchestra ends this concert by coming full circle back to Schumann, whose 200th birthday the Proms has been celebrating with a symphony cycle. Tonight, that's completed with his Beethovenian Second, in which he wrote himself cathartically through his depression. But before that comes the UK premiere of a piece by the Swedish composer Albert Schnelzer, for whom Beethoven was an important influence when he was growing up, alongside Pink Floyd. Improvisation's always been a strength of Schnelzer's. He remembers doing it on the piano at preschool, and he then learnt the guitar and he joined a rock band. He was originally going to be an engineer, but chucked that in to study composition, first in Malmö and then at the Royal College of Music, just across from the Royal Albert Hall. The biography in the programme says it was at the RCM he began to develop his natural leaning towards folk music, soft romantics and hard rock. Well, I talked earlier to Albert Schnelzer and conductor Thomas Dausgaard and asked Albert how A Freak in Burbank had come about.
The initial inspiration for this piece was, this was a commission. I was commissioned to write a piece for chamber orchestra with a sort of Haydn twist on it.
This was Esa-Pekka's idea.
Yes, it was. And so I started with him as sort of an inspiration. But during the time that I composed the piece, I also read a biography about Tim Burton, the film director. And I,
who you'd had quite a lot to do with as a youngster, I gather. I mean, you watched a lot of his films.
Yes, of course. So like many in my age, I've seen all his films, and I think they are simply amazing, most of them. And I like them a lot, actually. And what was interesting was that I found similarities instantly. The humour and the burlesque qualities was something that I found very interesting. And what happened was that Tim Burton, when he entered my mind, he more or less took over the piece. So it's, I would say it's 10% Haydn and 90% Tim Burton in the end. But that's the way it went. I had no choice but to let Tim Burton into the piece and let him guide me.
Does Tim Burton know?
Well, I don't know, actually. I haven't had any contact with him so far.
I think we should tell him.
Yeah.
His childhood is wrapped up in a piece by Albert Schnelzer.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's going to be flattered, especially since I called the piece A Freak in Burbank.
Well, that was...
Yeah, but I think his childhood was really interesting because he lived in a very typical American suburb in Burbank. But still, he was probably a really unusual child, and that was kind of, I don't know.
Tormenting his friends and things,
wasn't
he?
Yeah,
he sort of did. Playing tricks on them.
Yeah, and he tore the heads of the toy soldiers, and he did all kind of bizarre things. And I thought that was kind of, both funny and a bit sad at the same time.
Thomas, what appeals to you about Albert's music?
I think there's an immediacy here, and there's a storytelling which I really like. There's a tension, probably most important for me, which carries right through the piece, and it has a very rounded feeling performing it. It has a natural way of flowing along with the inspiring and interesting things all along the way. So there's something, I think, touching us on a very basic level here, and that's... that's done in a very sophisticated way.
You've talked about communication of music, you know, being so important to you. I mean, it's not about writing something that's going to be put on a dusty shelf and forgotten.
No.
You want your music to speak to people, don't you?
Yeah, I want to speak to people all the time, even when I don't write music. I don't think that should be odd in any way, but I see myself more of a storyteller. I have something that I hear in my mind that I want to tell people, tell them how things sound in my head. That's how I work.
And have you been on tour with the piece and with the orchestra, Thomas? I mean, is this in the middle of a whole...
This is in the middle of the tour, and we play a variety of repertoire, but this is on the tour as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's
And how's
been
it being received?
Very well. Always very immediate response. So, no doubt, it's very positive.
Thomas Dausgaard. And here he is again, coming onto the platform at the Royal Albert Hall, joining the Swedish Chamber Orchestra to give the UK premiere of Albert Schnelzer's A Freak in Burbank. was the UK premiere of Albert Schnelz's A Freak in Burbank, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to begin the second part of tonight's prom by the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. Going to Schnelz in that piece, he wanted one of his heroes, Haydn, to meet modern America and see if he survived. And Albert Schnelz comes flying down the steps onto the platform. Big hug for Thomas Dausgaard. You can hear the response for that piece. It was commissioned by the Stockholm Chamber Orchestra, first performed 2008. It's really taken off. 20 performances by 9 different orchestras. Dausgaard is going to do it with the Danish National Symphony Orchestra next month. It's in Canada next year. And Dausgaard and the Swedish Chamber are giving the German premiere at the Philharmonie in Berlin on their German tour soon. Back onto the platform, beaming Albert Schnelzer and Thomas Dausgaard. Impressive list of performances of many of his pieces this year. Musically looks up for James McMillan, Thomas Ades. Says the essence of music for him boils down to singing and dancing. His new oboe concerto, joint commission from tonight's band and the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, will be premiered this autumn. And there's a new cello concerto with a world premiere in Gothenburg next year, amongst much else. Great response here in the Royal Albert Hall. And the orchestra all grinning too, they love playing it. Well, Albert Schnelzer says one of his formative influences when he was growing up was Beethoven, and the Swedish Chamber Orchestra ends its prom with a symphony Beethoven would have both understood and admired, and maybe been rather flattered by, as Schumann was certainly taking him as his example when he wrote his second symphony. It wasn't an easy time for him. In the autumn of 1844, he had a complete physical and mental breakdown. The following year, he convalesced in Dresden, complaining the whole time of tinnitus in his ears, studying Bach and composing very little except this symphony. He saw it as depicting his struggle against depression. Schumann told the conductor of an early performance, "It was the resistance of the spirit that was here at work and helped me combat my condition," and added the music reminded him of a dark period. There are none of the outside references to nature or literature as in the title symphonies, the Spring or the Rhenish. The romantic spirit is absorbed into its own very personal world. Schumann saw the first movement as being full of his personal struggle, played out by two themes representing darkness and light, and the way they're used seemed to reflect his inner tension. That struggle spills over into the equally Beethovenian scherzo, as though Schumann's restless spirit was carrying too much unresolved conflict to settle down yet. It's energetic music rather than dramatic, the only relaxation coming in the two trios. The melancholy slow movement's one of the loveliest Schumann ever wrote, delicately scored with romantic horn calls juxtaposed with the plaintive main tune. And the movement ends with the music clothed in glowing orchestral colours. The finale is dominated by the resistance of the spirit theme of the opening, which drives forward to a victory over darkness, the music arriving at a semblance of peace, and a new song-like tune appears related to Beethoven's song cycle, An die ferne Geliebte, to the distant beloved, surely meant to be Schumann's wife Clara. When it and the resistance of the spirit theme get together, then at last the symphony can end in a blaze of triumphant C major. So here's Thomas Dausgaard once again coming onto the platform at the Royal Albert Hall to conduct the Swedish Chamber Orchestra in Schumann's Second Symphony.
Thank you.
major splendor as Schumann vanquishes his demons, for the moment anyway, at the end of his second symphony. It's been played here in the Royal Albert Hall to end tonight's BBC Prom by the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, Örebro. Leader Katarina Andreasen with its chief conductor Thomas Dausgaard. Good place to end this year's Prom Schumann Symphony cycle in celebration of the 200th anniversary of his birth. Wildness, risk-taking. Thomas Dausgaard says you need to do that, and he certainly was conducting the music, not the bars, bringing the wind to their feet. Swedish Chamber Orchestra, not a period instrument band, but playing with valveless trumpets and, as you heard, tightly strung timps, hard sticks, and very discreet vibrato. Complete. Swedish Chamber Orchestra on its feet now. Dausgaard says balance difficulties with symphony orchestras instantly resolved when playing Schumann with the Chamber Orchestra, and that this orchestra is about the same size as the Municipal Orchestra in Dusseldorf, of which Schumann was music director. It's not the only way, he says, but it brings greater clarity and flexibility. Certainly you heard that flexibility there. A great joy they all have in music making. I asked Dausgaard what the secret is to being a long-lived music director, as it were, 13 years. Well, they're applauding him hugely. Obviously a very warm relationship between orchestra and conductor, as Thomas Dausgaard brings the Swedish Chamber Orchestra to its feet. They had three concerts in Stockholm 2 days ago, a day of royal celebrations, ending with a concert performing Beatles numbers with a rock band. Thomas Dausgaard was a member of one when he was young. And tomorrow they're in Oslo, and their debut at the Salzburg Festival on Saturday. As for Thomas Dausgaard himself, he makes his debut with the Cleveland Orchestra this coming season, goes back to Toronto, to Cincinnati, to the Vienna Symphony. Here he is back on the platform. I think it's some more. Sibelius and Dante Festivo played as an encore by the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. Well, tomorrow here at the Proms, the orchestra comes from about as far away from central Sweden as it's possible to get. The Sydney Symphony Orchestra is in town for its first visit in 15 years, with its music director, Vladimir Ashkenazi, a far more regular visitor, of course. The suite from Richard Strauss's opera, Der Rosenkavalier, Ravel's G major piano concerto, with Hélène Grimaud, the soloist, sways to the blues. And continuing this year's Proms performances of Scriabin, his third symphony, The Divine Poem, seeks to join the human spirit and the universe in a cosmic dance. Thomas Dausgaard and his orchestra all on their feet, taking the applause of the audience. Well, that's at 7:30 tomorrow, live here on Radio 3, of course. But for now, time for me to hand you on to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, many thanks. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight. Just remind you that if you want to hear that prom again, you can do so on the afternoon of Bank Holiday Monday, a week today from 2 here on Radio 3. Tomorrow afternoon's prom repeat is another chance to hear the prom from last Tuesday. It featured the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Edward Gardner, beginning with that beautiful meditation on the life of Benjamin Britten by Arvo Pärt, with that bell tolling at the start and most powerfully at the end, the Cantus in Memoriam, Benjamin Britten. Britten's own music also features in the 4C interludes from Peter Grimes. Last Tuesday also heard a brand new violin concerto, a BBC commission from Hugh Watkins, and the afternoon will draw to a conclusion with a performance of Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. That's all from 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. And earlier in the day...
On Breakfast, each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties, in Breakfast on Radio 3, every morning from 7.
And that was Sarah Moore-Peach. Well, what of the rest of the evening tonight on Radio 3? Next is our next in the series of Monday evening in-depth conversations with notable musicians. Continuing at 9:45, Norman Lebrecht will be talking to the American-born pianist Stephen Kovacevich, who's celebrating his 70th birthday this year. He made his Wigmore Hall debut back in 1961, and he'll be reflecting on life in the fast lane of the music business as it developed in the intervening years in this week's Lebrecht interview. That's all after A Short Jig by William Byrd. Canadian Brass playing the music of William Byrd, bringing the time now to 9:45. We have music by Mendelssohn at 10:30, a performance by members of the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme, the Elias Quartet. And at 11, David Crystal ponders what Samuel Johnson would have made of the internet. It's the first of our week of late-night essays considering Johnson now. And the first one, Johnson, the Dictionary, the Wiki and the Web, is at 11 this evening. And if you're a jazz fan, then do join Jez Nelson after that for a concert by the pianist Django Bates and his trio Beloved Bird. They're playing interpretations of the music of Charlie Parker in Jazz on 3 at 11:15 this evening. Programmes for the rest of the night here on BBC Radio 3. And before all of that, it's time for this week's Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Stephen Bishop Kovacevich is a pianist for whom the adjective classical might have been invented. He confines himself to old masters, Beethoven and Brahms, Mozart and Schubert, and he plays with deep penetration and a lofty disdain for changes of style and fashion. He's old school and proud of it. When the music industry was at its busiest, he, together with Vladimir Ashkenazy and Alfred Brendel, covered the core repertoire. An American of Croatian heritage, he came to London in 1959 to study with Dame Myra Hess and never really left. He's changed his name twice and shared intense relationships with Jacqueline Dupré and Martha Argerich, yet he's always stood apart from the star circuit, occupying a space entirely his own. On October 17, when he turns 70, he'll be joined by musicians young and old for a momentous birthday celebration at the Wigmore Hall. Stephen Kovacevich, did you ever think of yourself as a leader of the field? Did you look in the mirror and think, I've made it?
I think I've said to myself, I've made it. Leader, there isn't a leader in anything. I don't actually think in those terms. Obviously, I prefer some people in a certain repertoire, me included, or not. But leader is it's a dead burden.
But you've talked to the field as being highly competitive.
Well, there are a lot of good people, people who have something to offer.
And that sense of satisfaction of having sort of joined the leaders, being on the leaderboard.
Well, I know I've achieved something, yes. I won't paint myself into a corner more than that.
Just tell me then, when you felt you'd achieved that, what did it take for you to achieve that?
I would say facetiously, I'm still looking forward to it. But I suppose it was hearing some recordings I made, which made me actually think, hey, wait, this really is something. Brahms 2 with Colin Davis, Bartok 2 with Colin Davis. And so it's an accumulation of hearing some of the good things you've done, realizing that more often than not, that is what happens. And then inevitably you hear other people in your repertoire and you sometimes think, why, I wish I could do that. Or you think, I'm glad I couldn't do that. So it alternates. But I think, by and large, you do have an idea where you are. But anybody who is really personal is unique. And I think that's what you really try to bring out.
You've described yourself somewhere as a gloomy sod, with something of Dostoevsky in your soul.
Well, I wish as intelligent as he is, but yeah, gloomy is quite often the case, yes.
And where does that come from?
Have no idea. You could say Croatian blood, Slavic blood, I don't know. It's quite strong, although I enjoy my life. But underneath it all is a festering malcontent.
Isn't that essential for an artist?
Well, if it is, I've got it, but I don't know I don't know if it's essential.
Let's go back to beginnings. Your father jumped ship in Los Angeles in 1939.
Something like that, yeah.
Was he running away from Europe, away from war, or was he...
I think he was running away from Europe. He arrived, his brothers were already there, he didn't speak any English. And he had been trained as an engineer, but they all made a fortune, they all lost it. But they made a fortune in fishing. He was one of the first people to do frozen fish, but he had some notoriously bad business dealings in South America, and it all went up the spout. But for a time, he was wealthy and successful.
But you grew up fairly comfortable because he was doing quite well from quite early
yes.
on?
Yes, when I was no more than five, we had a very good sound system, and I fell in love with music through hearing Mozart 40. Well, if you speak of gloom, I remember thinking, there must be something I don't know about life that anybody should write music like this. that is obviously a deep response to music, and not a particularly happy character, even at 4.5 or 5. That's why the opening of Mozart 40 is sacred to me. You don't mess with it. And there's a darkness. A good friend of mine described it as a homage to inner anguish, and it's true. But I picked that up when I was 5. I also loved Wagner. I thought Wagner was great. And
Ride of the Valkyries, was it?
No, Meistersinger. Mm. Still to this day, I loved the Toscanini performance of the Prelude. And Johann Strauss. Those are the three people I loved.
Were you already playing at 5?
No, I played badly when I was around 7, less badly when I was 8, and well, when I was 11.
You were already taking lessons then with...
Lev Shor, a Russian, and I stayed with him until I was 18 and came here to Myra Hess.
How did you find Lev Shor?
He was very, very good in terms of accuracy, rhythmic verve, and characterization. I mean, he was a good musician. But when I came to Myra Hess, I think my playing was rather limited in variation in sound, I think. And she opened up a whole world, because whatever you say about her, I mean, I do think she was a deep and great artist, but her sound had huge range. And that was a revelation, and it inspired me.
Your parents weren't together for very long?
No.
How old were you when...
I don't know, 2 or 3, something like that.
And then your mother remarried a man called Bishop.
That's why I got struck with this name, Bishop.
And did you see much of your father when you were growing up?
He was very much persona non grata, because the marriage was a bad breakup. So not until I was adolescent did I see him, but only then, once or twice a year. And furtively and guiltily, because it was of a generation when people didn't know how to divorce. I think they're better at it now.
But they were Catholics. It can't have been easy at any time.
No, but I mean the thing of the children not being allowed to like the bad boy.
So you started out as Stephen Bishop.
I started off as Kovacevic.
But you made your name as Stephen Bishop.
Yes.
And then against all music industry advice, you changed to Bishop Kovacevic. And then finally you changed to Kovacevic.
Yes.
And was that a kind of atonement for your father? Was it
Well, he had always wanted me to use the name Kovacevic, but for family reasons at the time, and also I suppose I didn't have the guts, but I also think the family dynamics were such that my mother would have been too upset. So it wasn't going to happen.
Was it also a way of expressing the Croat in you?
Yes.
It was reaching for that particular heritage?
The tradition of great Slavic performers was something I was hoping to be part of.
Your mother you've described as rather pushy, someone who wanted you to succeed, but at the same time, because she needed you around, she also wanted your career, you said, to be a disaster.
That's an amalgamation of quotes. It's not quite right. She wasn't pushy. No, I'll give her that. She wasn't pushy. I had for example, when I was adolescent, I had sport, and I had a fairly normal time. In the state schools at that time were very cooperative. I was home practicing at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. About the career, I think when she realized that I was going to have a life of my own and she wouldn't be part of it, then I think that it's possible that some bitterness crept in. And if I had disasters, and of course I did from time to time, I wouldn't say she opened up champagne, but it probably assuaged some bitterness, yes.
And was there the sort of response from her that this is because you left me and went halfway across the world?
Well, that kind of thing, I think, yes. It's rather curious that that was so strong in her, but I think it was.
Very hard for you to live with. Well, conflicting messages.
You're prone to guilt about everything that way, because one of the ways to anger the Furies is to do one of the unpardonable things, that is, not to love one or both of your parents. And so there I was, and that surely had consequences. And I also believed in the Catholic faith at the time. Now there aren't words for how I would treat the catechism, but then that also induces guilt, because you're made to feel that your essence is, you know, flawed and the whole thing. So it was a tough but by no means unusual background.
Stephen, would you say it was as much formative as it was inhibiting, that you were getting these conflicting messages of which parent to follow, or that one parent was excluded?
No, I think that was... My father became an uncle figure more than anything else. No, I think the conflicting messages is not a conflicting message, but it's a... If you see one parent, my mother, so unhappy, it's actually unbearable. And so you try to construct a... You think, why should it happen? Why should life be so unfair on this person? She had very bad health. And I think part of my original drive, the passion for late Beethoven, is that one of the subtexts is that there is consolation, there is radiance, there is ultimately some benign destiny. Now, I don't have that anymore at all, but I still love late Beethoven as much. I can't explain why I do. I've lost the comfort, the promise that it implied, but I still love the music as much as I ever did. It's the music and the late quintets of Mozart and mazurkas of Chopin that I love most of all.
When you carry on playing it now without the comfort,
yeah,
how does that feel?
I'm still as taken by it as I ever was. But when I play Opus 110, which I've recently started playing again, I find the piece more and more mysterious, which is a wonderful thing to find. And the Diabelli, I played a lot when I was young, and then I stopped for 25 or 30 years. And as you probably know, I recently brought it back. And the end of the Diabelli is rather similar to something in Mozart. I don't know what exactly in Mozart, but this feeling of transcendence and grace, grace and transcendence takes over. The last minuet is absolutely amazing music. And there's nothing that I can think of that is quite so Mozartian in spirit in Beethoven as that. Again, Beethoven, whether he had comfort or not with his own muse, I don't know, because if I believe one of the last things, he had a tough life. People don't realize how much physical pain this man had. And although I was pleased to read that as a young man, he had quite a romantic life, and people were quite jealous how this ugly guy could have so much fun. But that certainly faded, and he was lonely and single, and with a great deal of physical pain. And one of the last things he said, apparently, is, oh, the comedy is over now. This is deathbed stuff. Hmm. And what he meant by that, we don't know whether he... But it's certainly not a... It's not a radiant thing to say.
Yeah. Lev Shore, your teacher.
Yeah.
Russian tradition.
Russian tradition.
Chopin, Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff.
Yes, yes, yes.
You've never played Rachmaninoff in public.
I love it.
But you never played it?
I've never played it. I learned the third, and then I couldn't face the night before the first rehearsal, and I knew I couldn't.
So you were actually going to play the D minor and...
6 months before, I knew that. Because the most difficult piece I'd learned until then, and it is as hard in its way, is Bartok II. And that took me 9 months of slavery. I paralyzed my right hand during the time. I had to have therapy to unlock it. And, okay, the first performances were okay, not very good. But I eventually really, really did learn to play this piece. And I think that the ferocity and the anger in Bartok II probably suited me when I was a young man. A Rachmaninoff third is a great piece, but I'm not sure it appeals to the inner demon as much as Bartok II. I think they're all wonderful. He's the greatest pianist, in my opinion, of them all, a view not only shared by me. I'm interested now in number 4, which is the so-called Ugly Duckling, but I think that the small interlude in the last movement is as beautiful as anything he or anybody ever wrote. It's a curious piece, very economic.
One that sounds a little bit like Three Blind Mice.
The middle movement is Three Blind Mice. Mm. As a composer, parenthetically, it's curious because he said, why? Because Three Blind Mice is also the Schumann concerto in a way. He said, why didn't anybody tell me? But the fact that a composer would say, why didn't anybody tell me, is completely nuts. It comes from a prelude, and that when the prelude was written, it had its own beauty, and it never occurred to him that it was influenced by any other music.
So from a very early age, you're aware that there are composers and pianists that you admire.
Love, not admire.
Love.
Love.
But that you wouldn't emulate and their works you wouldn't play.
Yes. Also, the music that I choose to listen to isn't necessarily the music that I play. The only exception where it all fits is, and I do them well, but I don't do them in public very often, though this may change, the mazurkas. Now, the rubato implied in the mazurka is something that, first of all, I think it's in your blood, except for Futsong, who really, really is not noticeably Slavic, but he does have this rubato in his blood somewhere.
So and you just have to come from the far end of the Danube if you're going to play
that. I'm probably talking nonsense. But the waltzes can be done, let's say, for me, not so well, and I don't really mind. But if a mazurka is done with pseudo-rubato and fake rubato, it actually enrages me. I can't bear it, because this is some of the greatest music ever written. And I know quite a few of the mazurkas. But to show you how difficult this rhythm is, or this rubato, let's say I didn't have to practice and there was a piano here. I could play the notes. It would take me weeks to get the rubato back.
I mean, it's fascinating to me that you should have formed these aesthetic compartments so early in your life that you knew what you were going to play and the particular style that you wanted for it. And that this has just developed, obviously, and matured.
Yes.
But, well, but the self-knowledge...
Knowledge is too cold a word. I would think just intuition. For better or for worse, that's where I am.
And then Myra Hess came to town.
Great.
And you heard a different way of playing. We tend to think of her in England as a national monument, a kind of...
That was the death of her.
Yeah. We still think of her as a kind of Boadicea who carried on playing Beethoven at the National Gallery while Nazi bombs were exploding all around her.
It was so, in purely crude show business terms, she was overexposed. You took her for granted. And this did have a consequence, because she played more wildly in America than she ever did here. I heard her in America. You wouldn't recognize it. And blasphemy of blasphemy, she actually preferred, though she wouldn't admit it, the American Steinway, because it was raucous and it was, you know, it had a wild quality. And she responded. She could fill Carnegie Hall. There aren't many people who can do that. And she played differently. When she played here, it was like, you know, auntie giving tea. And it's destructive because it inhibits you if you think the public views you in a certain way. And there was a generation of bright young things coming down from Cambridge and Oxford writing reviews about her, which were completely making their own name and dismissive of what was great with her. They had their own ambitious ends. That's their business. But it hurt.
Did she discuss herself with you? Or she was very much the teacher. She was very much leading you into paths.
To my surprise, she was Christian in some sense, though being Jewish. I don't know what that meant to her, but it meant something.
What do you mean by being Christian?
Well, I mean, she would say the Lord and things like that, which implied that it meant something to her. I don't know what it meant to her, but it surprised me.
And you got a scholarship to come over and study.
Yes, from the University of California. I was just treating them as a conservatory, just using their practice pianos. And they knew I had to get out of Berkeley in order to do anything. And they, through something called the Hertz Award, but they administered it, they gave me 2 years carte blanche to come here. And, of course, it was the making of me.
What was the revelation for you from Myra Hess?
We both loved late Beethoven. I didn't like Beethoven when I was an adolescent, but I heard Serkin's recording of the Diabelli and fell in love with that. She, of course, had heard the Diabelli but didn't know it. And we, as it were, discovered it together because I wanted to learn it and play it. And it was a study of 6 or 9 months, something. And she adored this music. And so the revelation was the joy and the mystery and the wonder that is there. I mean, the other sonatas she knew. Her hands weren't big enough to play the Hammerklavier, but she loved this music, and she would have done it magnificently. She just couldn't stretch it.
So were you in some sense a surrogate, that you were pushing out her way of playing into a new generation? You were continuing the tradition?
Well, I think, I don't know surrogate, but I think I was influenced strongly, and I appreciate it and acknowledge it in the last 10 years, maybe more than I did earlier.
The other dominant figure in late Beethoven, if we're talking of late Beethoven, is, of course, Arthur Schnabel. How did that affect you? How did the whole Schnabel way?
Well, when I was an adolescent and heard his recordings, I was struck, but I was also amazed by the inaccuracies of it, you know, in a rather prim fashion. But
the freedom to play wrong notes.
Well, he was very free. But now I'd rather hear him play the Hammerklavier with the millions of wrong notes than most people with all the right notes. I'm exaggerating slightly, but not much. And certainly the sarcasm implied in what I'm saying has truth in it, because we tend to type things these days, and you couldn't call him a typist.
I don't think we could call you a typist.
No, I hope not.
Did Myra Hess open doors to you, to the music establishment?
Well, her agent, Emmy Tillett, the doyen of...
Mrs. Tillett.
Of course, she took me on, and that was a huge thing.
And Mrs. Tillett arranged your debut?
That's...
1961?
Yes. It cost £60 in those days to hire and give a concert at the Wigmore Hall.
What do you remember of it?
I remember arriving Sunday afternoon. It was snowing, and the program was Berg Sonata, Three Preludes and Fugues of Bach and the Diabelli. I began the Berg Sonata, and like it or not, or whether you understand the music or not, the first eight bars of the Berg Sonata can be sight-read. You know, it's not really difficult. I looked out at my hands, and they were shaking, and I thought, my God, in 45 minutes, I have to play the Diabelli. This isn't going to happen. Well, it did. That's what I remember, because I had no experience of giving concerts, almost none.
So nerves.
Frightful, yes.
And that pursued you?
Yeah, they're much better recently, in the last couple of years, 5 or 6 years, maybe slightly more. But
what did you do about it?
I've tried all the usual things.
Beta blockers?
I mean, I haven't taken a beta blocker in 25 years, but I took them for a short time. And, you know, you're so slow and you're so bored. I believe they're more sophisticated now. But in any case, it didn't help. What did actually help was, well, I don't know what age gives you, but it's not completely negative. And very close to being completely negative, but not totally. And one of the things is you become tougher. And I mean, I had some health problems in the last few years, and I played some stinking concerts during that time. But that was absolutely health orientated. But you get tougher. Still, it's not a picnic walking on stage, but you do get tougher.
When you go on stage, do you feel as if you have a right to be there?
Yes.
You've earned it.
I don't know if I've earned it, but I have a right to be there.
Okay. So why would you feel nervous if you have a right to be
there? Well, because there's always things that can go wrong. I mean, Horowitz had more technique than most people would ever dream about, and he made colossal mistakes. That can happen. And if that does happen, it's terrifying. I'm not talking about a slip of a note or something. But I can understand why, for example, in his first recording of the Third Rachmaninoff, there's a little cadenza, which actually isn't hard to play. But Rachmaninoff writes veloce. Now, to someone like Horowitz or to someone like me, that's just the worst thing, because you know you're going to get overexcited. You're going to go too fast. And Horowitz, during Rachmaninoff's lifetime, completely rewrote that little cadenza, not because he couldn't play in his sleep. And there's also this thing of temptation of, if you're not tempted into something dangerous, how are you able to achieve something exciting? I don't think it's a free pass. There are people today who can play octaves as fast as Horowitz. It doesn't mean that they give you goose pimples. And I once played for Horowitz. It was an absolutely fantastic evening. I arrived at 9. I left at 2 in the morning. And he was polite and gracious and wonderful. Now, he started to play something, and I was at the other end of the piano. There was an octave passage coming up, and I wanted to look at his hands, but I decided not to, because I thought it was cheap. I wouldn't learn anything. In those days, I was a little clairvoyant. And he stopped playing, and he said, "You're right." He said, "People come here," and this is all to do with typing or not. He said, "People come here and think they can steal octaves. You have to have a Mephistophelian spirit to play octaves. And that's why today people can play quickly, but they don't play with that furore that makes them exciting. You hear, not necessarily the recording, but one of the Toscanini Tchaikovsky things that are available. And the last passage is actually frightening. And it's not necessarily faster, although it is excruciatingly fast, but this spirit. And so you walk on stage, and in your own way, you delve into that. And that is not a free pass. You don't type that. And there are passages in Beethoven. I'm sorry, Beethoven is not a safe composer. There are passages which are meant to be, they are dangerous. They're meant to be dangerous. They should be dangerous for the performer, and the audience should feel part of this, whatever it is. And that doesn't come from conservatory preparation. That comes from an inner compulsion, an intuition.
So this is the beginning. You make your debut.
Yeah.
You get married about the same time. You're 20 years old.
Yeah.
Your wife is a Catholic and a psychoanalyst. You have two sons. This is all happening, isn't it?
Yes. Much too soon, but nevertheless, worthwhile. Yes.
And it's London, it's the 1960s, and things are starting to swing.
Yeah.
How are you affected by all of that?
After a while, I partook of the London freedom. Not for 5 or 6 years after that. And that was a good period for everybody.
Through Mrs. Tillett, you met this exuberant young cellist, Jacqueline Dupré.
Yes, that is the person I've most enjoyed working with in my life.
Almost immediately, you were giving recitals around the country.
Pretty soon. And she was, well, she is the most gifted musical person I've encountered.
What was the most appealing thing?
Well, she had a kind of genius. You know, the film that Christopher Nupin made where she plays the piano. She couldn't play the piano. I tell you, you hear Jackie even when she's playing the piano. You hear something, and I don't know how it works. I really don't know how it works. Maybe some love of music. She had a wonderful attitude towards performing. She was atheist, but she used some religious terms. She said, I've been given a God-given talent, and it's my privilege to share it with my friends. Well, there's not a better attitude in life than that.
You were so different, though. She was so impetuous, you were so serious.
Well, it worked. And we recorded two Beethoven sonatas, the A major, which is good, but on the goody-goody side, and the D major, which really is wonderful.
Incredible.
Yeah, that is incredible.
Yes.
There's no other way to describe it. It is incredible.
It's quite miraculous.
Yeah.
Part of the miracle are these two contrasting temperaments, you and her,
yes,
coming together.
She's the only one who I've ever persuaded, but I didn't need persuade, to play the last movement really quickly. Everybody's so scolar, because it's very difficult with the piano. Actually, it isn't any easier if you play slowly. You're just, you know, it doesn't really help. And the slow movement, the first movement I don't think is especially problematic, and ours is good, but there are plenty of others that are good too. But the second and third movements, there's a depth to the slow movement. And I remember recording this at Abbey Road. We didn't even look at each other during these slow passages when you have to play chords together. Didn't even look. There was a complete rapport. And the last movement really takes off. And I wish people would play it like that, because instead of a sort of poor man's fugetta.
When she fell ill in the 70s,
yeah,
with multiple sclerosis, and she went into rapid decline, you were one of her most treasured visitors.
The last 4 years of her life, I saw her once a month. That wasn't at the onset of her illness. But it's true, the last 4 years, I was there once a month. Well, not only me, there were other people who you went in, you saw, you looked ahead in her diary. When there was a free night, you made sure that somebody was there. And if you were free, you put yourself down.
It was organized.
Yeah.
And you shared what you'd had, or you...
I don't know how she did it. Mm. I don't know how she did it, but there would be half a minute in which the old magic was still there. I don't know how it happened. She hated being ill, and all the people who were close to her, you couldn't get over it. Probably for the first year or so when I started to visit her, I thought about it all the time. I tried to make sense of it, which, of course, is just nonsense.